shock and embarrassment as the Oscars reached fever pitch on Sunday night. And the winner is...
La La Land.
Or was it?
This is not a joke. Moonlight has won Best Picture.
With live cameras rolling, presenters read out the wrong envelope for the most important award. A dramatic Oscars upset playing out in real time.
It's all the rage on Wall Street. The upcoming chance to buy a piece of Snap Inc., the parent of Snapchat, and the biggest debut for a U.S. tech company since Facebook. Sources tell Reuters the demand for the IPO, which could come as early as next week, is so strong, it's already oversubscribed.
In order to be a successful company, I think you need to make money. So you need to have a bottom line. So that's why that is a hygiene factor, as I call it. But we, of course, need to invest to make sure that we stay ahead of the game. But it's really only by being profitable we will be able to invest for the future. 5G is really starting to happening. That doesn't mean it's commercially deployed yet.
Yeah.
But what we're starting to see is operators positioning their 4G networks and starting to evolve into 5G.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Monday. It is February 27th, 2017, 5:10 in the morning. Glad to have you along for another edition of The Opening Bell. Another business week getting underway, the last week of February, as we get ready to welcome in March. Lots going on the show today. Coming up in a moment, our CEO Spotlight. A little bit later in the program, we're going to be talking to Dr. Robert Marks. He's a professor of surgery and chief of the Division of Oral and Maxillofacial Surgery at University of Miami. He's going to be with us today talking about deadly prescriptions, this prescription business. Are they in it to make money, or are they in it to help us, or both, or is there something else going on? A little bit later in our program. But first, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning, Dow futures are inching lower this morning after the record run for blue chip stocks may be coming to an ending. Dow off about 8 points, the futures are, as we head toward the opening bell. S&P and NASDAQ futures are lower as well. Around the globe this morning, the stocks generally lost ground as investors scaled back bets that President Trump's policies would promote faster economic growth and instead favored bonds and gold in their trading efforts. Trading this morning, European markets are mixed, with the FTSE and DAX higher. The CAC is lower. In Asia this morning, all of the indices are lower, with looks like the Asian Dow leading the way, followed by the Shanghai Composite off nearly 1% there. The Nikkei off 176 points. At about a full percent this morning. Oil is trading at $54.32 a barrel. That's up almost a half a percent. The dollar edged up against the yen and the euro. U.S. crude, again, at $54 a barrel, seems to be holding steady there. Investors are looking ahead to President Trump's speech tomorrow to a joint session of Congress for details about how he plans to carry out promises to cut taxes and step up infrastructure spending. Stocks have been buoyed by Trump's promise of pro-business changes and tax reform. Analysts say less money is flowing into Trump trades, though, that would benefit from the president's promised changes. People on Wall Street, investors are eager to see some of the details. Some other news happening today. The London Stock Exchange says its planned merger with Deutsche Börse is likely to be blocked after the European Commission raised antitrust concerns. The merger announced almost a year ago would have given the German financial exchange a majority stake in the combined company. Negotiators from 16 Asian countries are meeting in the Japanese port city of Kobe this week for talks on regional trade that could supplant the Trans-Pacific Partnership projected by the U.S. China is playing a leading role in the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP. You'll want to remember that, RCEP, which faces hurdles of its own. Still, there are some parts of it, though, that may be agreeable to the U.S. and other countries. It could supplant TPP. As Republicans try to unite around a replacement for the Affordable Care Act, one of the popular parts of the law will be among the most difficult to replace, according to a new report, the guarantee of health coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. Under the health care law, insurance companies are required to cover people with serious medical problems. President Trump says he wants to keep that in place, but some Republicans favor state-based solutions, including high-risk pools where people without many options, would end up paying much higher rates if they are approved at all. more women in the boardroom, more CEOs, female CEOs, more women in politics, more women in civic groups. It is something that Kate Benson pushes for every day as president and CEO of the Chicago Network. Kate is with us today in our CEO spotlight. Good morning, Kate. Welcome to the opening bell.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
This is a good point because we're still early on in the year to talk about the organization and your leadership and sort of the priorities for the coming year. Let's start with that.
Sure. Well, at the Chicago Network, we're focused on a couple of different things. I did want to pause and talk about something we're doing in the early part of 2017. We've started a series called the Chicago Cabinet. Part one of the series convened 160 members and guests at Morningstar. And we had a conversation moderated by Kathy Brock. And it was really what should the agenda for women in the workforce look like for the administration? Cabinet number two is really going to focus on empowering women to promote civility in the workplace, their communities.
Before we go further, let's talk a little bit about the Chicago Network. What is it about and who's a part of it?
So let me just start by saying that the Chicago Network was founded in 1979. What was true then is true now, and it is lonely at the top. That unfortunately has not changed. So our members are some of the most influential senior professional women in Chicago. We're the only organization that draws across a broad spectrum of professions. So we not only have Fortune 100 C-suite executives, we also have university presidents. We have entrepreneurs, the women who run the cultural and other leading nonprofits in the city. And we're really proud to have four astrophysicists, all world class.
It is, as you talk about the initiatives that are ongoing this year, I always hate to ask for a report card on those issues. But is there a way you can generally tell us women in the boardroom, equal pay, women in political positions of leadership? What would the grades be in those areas?
I would phrase it in terms of progress rather than grades, and progress is glacial. If you look at the boardroom, we go up a percent, we go down a percent. It's not where it needs to be. Similarly, we've seen some changes in the number of women elected representatives. In equal pay, the studies are out there. We're a long way from being where we need to be.
So if it is glacial, your job must be monumental. And that is, how do you get this moving? How do you move the glacier?
Well, we hope that the glacier will move in a couple of different ways. One, leadership and culture come from the top, and we look to CEOs to set the culture and tone and accountability within their organizations in the way that Miles White has at Abbott, and really tying meeting diversity goals to compensation. We also, at least in terms of the boardroom, this won't affect the internal organization, but large institutional investors are really starting to press for more diversity in the boardroom. So we feel that where there is not that leadership and culture at the top, that external forces will hopefully drive change.
And that's a big thing, that this pressure from investors that seems to have not been there in the past or maybe in low numbers is really starting to increase. Is that because of what, do you think?
I think it's because of their desire to see change in the boardroom. Boards are pale, male, and stale.
We always, on this show, when we talk about this issue, we covered a lot. We always have to take a breath and say, well, these are 50% of the ideas that we're not getting. This is 50% of the input, the economic ideas, the inspiration that we're not getting. It just seems like a big hole.
It is a big hole. And, you know, the research is there that companies that have more diversity of thought and ideas and ethnicity and gender, both in the boardroom and in leadership positions, have better financial performance.
And are there examples of that that you can give us? You've mentioned one at the top there, but what would be some other good examples of that?
You know, I think Ulta is a great example. Ingredion. We periodically publish a census with Deloitte, our data gathering partner. And there are some superstar companies. We also see companies that might not be at the very top, but we know that they're driving change. And we are very heartened by what we're seeing by some of the leading CEOs in Chicago.
As the CEO of the Chicago Network, what is from your past that helps you at this moment, in this time, in this position, do best?
You know, I think it is a sense of curiosity and a desire to be a builder and a connector, bringing those things to the party.
And give us a sense of how you connect that. Is it just getting millennials, young millennial women involved? Is it helping people find their voice that can't find their voice now?
Well, we do a couple of different things, and I'm really glad you mentioned millennials. I'd like to start with our Future Leaders Program. We partner with three less resource universities in the area, St. Xavier, UIC, and now this year Dominican. And we offer their college sophomore and juniors, often first-generation college students, meaningful career exposure. So these young women who are selective, and it's very competitive, will spend 2 days of their break, one with a business and one with a nonprofit, where we have members in leadership. So they will meet the senior leader. They will also meet newer employees. They'll tour the operations. And our goal is really to expand their horizons in terms of what they can do with their degrees. We are also tweaking our strategic plan. We're very focused on relevance, and we are starting an outreach program into selected communities of professional millennial women called Office Hours or Ask Me Anything. And a member will spend about an hour with young millennial women, and we'll spend a little bit of time talking about the network. She'll spend, maybe 10, 15 minutes talking about her career journey, and then they can ask her anything that they're curious about. And then we're going to spend the last part of this program asking their advice. What do they want and need from us, and how can we best deliver to that to them? So our goal is really to forge a relationship and be resourceful to each other, so that when these young women become network eligible, they want to join.
And the young men, women who may be thinking about this, what are the characteristics that you can point out that might be the characteristics of a good leader? Or I know that might be a difficult thing to just put into different aspects, but what would you say?
You know, I would say it's someone who is a good listener, who makes a successful transition from manager to leader, knowing when to step away and empower a team, but with a clear vision of where they need to go and the ability to bring people along. It also involves a lot of humility and a great self-awareness, and I'm quoting Harry Kramer here, a great self-awareness of your strengths and weaknesses.
Are you seeing that in this new generation, the millennial generation?
Absolutely. I want to bust some myths here. The millennial women that I've encountered have been intensely dedicated to their careers, wanting to make a difference, passionate about what they do, and not afraid to roll up their sleeves and work hard. I really value my encounters with millennials. Yeah. And I have millennials on my staff. I'm the only non-millennial.
Yeah. And the sky's the limit. There's an amount of loyalty, too, that they seem to have, not only to the people they work for, but also with this notion of we can make it better.
Well, they absolutely can. And I think, you know, their valuing of experiences over material things, their desire to drive change, their expectation that their employer is going to make the world a better place, I think are very positive motivators for all of us.
The issues that I talked about, the equality in pay, the boardrooms, the CEOs having more women in politics, what role do men play in that?
I'm so glad you brought that up. Women have spent years, building programs, BRGs, and it's only now that we all recognize that men have to be part of the conversation. Men are still primarily, running things. They're pulling the levers of leadership. And not to involve them is foolish. A prime example of a company where the men are heavily involved is NiSource. So Carrie Heitman, who's one of our members, is general counsel, and she started a big women's summit. But from day one, the chairman of the company or the board chair and the CEO have always attended, and they allow men to attend. It's only by involving men in the process that you will really drive change and really fight things like unconscious bias.
And the process, too, could be as having them as a mentor. Also, I know you've been quoted in the past as saying a sponsor. What do you mean by that?
So, I think we all know what a mentor is, but a sponsor is even more critical. A sponsor is someone you may not even know you have one. And that is someone who's going to speak up for you. And when a promotion comes up, say, you know what, have you considered Mary? She's done this, this, and this, and I think she's worthy of the slot.
Do you go in search of a sponsor with the organization you're in, or do they find you?
I think they generally find you. But there are companies, particularly large employers, that are endeavoring to do formal sponsorship programs. And I'm really curious and eager to hear the, you know, kind of long-term results as to how that's going to work and how effective it is.
Your background is interesting because before you were in this position, you took a little break from your career as an attorney.
I did.
And you kind of found what you wanted to do in that break. How important to women and men is taking a break like that?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's taking a break per se, but it's always pursuing joy in what you do. So I was in a little bit of a different position than a lot of women my age who chose to step off. But I wasn't stepping off from work. I was stepping towards something. When I married, I had two, and I still have two wonderful stepsons, but, you know, we wrote our checks a little bit earlier. And so I was in a position to step back and pursue my dream of working inside and running an organization, one that's mission-driven and impactful. And that included taking a large volunteer gig where I had the opportunity to hone the skills I would need to take the network position.
Having you here and answering questions is a big plus for not only us, but for people who are listening right now. So I'm going to ask you some questions that might help listeners who may be in management positions. Let's start with that. What advice would you give them if they're in a management position to run their company or run their organization well? And maybe also advice to people who are pushing into that management job.
Oh, absolutely. I think the advice is the same. It's really to think early in your career about where you want to go in an organization. It may be the very top, it may be middle management, and figure out the path to get there. I think you should always be seeking opportunities to expand your horizons, to see different aspects of the organization, whether you're now a manager or you're someone seeking to be a manager. I think it's really important to focus on then making that leap from manager to leader. And there's a big difference. It's important to develop your skills as a team player, as a listener, and as someone who is present in whatever they're doing.
And as people work their way into these positions, how big of a role does networking play? And what advice do you have for being a good networker?
Absolutely. Networking is critical. You need to start early. My big aha moment about networking was as a first-year associate at Schiff Hardin. And, you know, we're trying to figure out how to be competent. Where is the bathroom? And one of my classmates was already getting business. And we're like, my goodness, how in the world did that happen? Well, this woman was very smart. She kept in touch with everyone she had gone to college with and, you know, who was a good friend. And some of those people went to work for corporations, and they found their way into the legal department and in a position to direct business. And that's how Linda started building a book of business as a first-year associate. That was my aha moment. I think approaching networking as being a connector, as being helpful, very much in the Adam Grant, be a giver, not a taker. Givers do succeed. And have men as well as women in your network. And don't make it transactional. Don't focus on, you know, what they're going to do for you. Focus on what you can do for them.
I often meet people who have a very difficult time networking. And they don't ever know if they're being too pushy, if they're not being pushy enough. What do you say to somebody who might be a little shy in that area?
Well, it can be learned. No one is a born networker. I mean, I love it. It's like osmosis, but I didn't come out of the womb networking. So approach it with joy, not trepidation. And if you really listen to other people, focus on being a listener and how you can be helpful to them. They're going to want to be helpful to you.
What would you say about the technical parts of this? Is there a social network that you use? Do you use Twitter or LinkedIn or Facebook? Or what would you recommend?
Well, you know, I think it's generational. Mm-hmm. So I'm a boomer, and I use LinkedIn a lot, but I also use Twitter. But I'm very careful when I'm on Twitter. I tweet as TCN CEO. My tweets are only about issues that are core to our mission. So you'll see a lot of things on women in the boardroom, equal pay, women's advancement in the workplace generally. Facebook is personal, but you won't see anything more than sunsets and things like that.
We recently saw the women's marches across the country. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in your take on those and the size of those crowds that we saw.
It was just exhilarating. And I think it was terrific to see the evolution from let's have a march to these are the things we're marching for. To have such a positive, uplifting atmosphere, a collective gathering of women and men. My stepson marched, went from New York to Washington. I'm very proud of him. Is very inspiring, and I hope we don't lose that collective spirit of bringing each other along and marching towards and working towards positive ends.
Many of those events, too, in addition to having men at them, they were nonpartisan. Even though a lot of the national focus was on the White House, there were a lot of nonpartisan events, too. And is that a good message to portray for the year, that we can tackle problems and be nonpartisan?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the joys of the marches and some of the other things that are going on is it's about inclusiveness. I mean, what we heard in the election is that people genuinely feel left behind. And unless we can build proximity to those who feel left behind, we'll continue to be a polarized country and we will not be driving towards anything positive.
I've had many tell me that that feeling that they had of, after the march and during the march, of being part of the solution, is it propelled them to continue on doing things until now and through the year. Is that part of it, too, to have that feeling? Do you have to have that feeling to be successful?
I think it's energizing. That's part of the reason we're doing the Chicago Cabinet Series, and really focusing in this next conversation on how we can have positive impact in our own workplaces and communities. The third conversation, though, is going to be sobering. It's going to really focus on, I think, bursting that wonderful bubble of women's advancement and equality that we were living in, and really empowering our attendees to fight for gender equality, and what are the tools we can have in our toolkit to do that, because in some ways the gloves came off.
So for those listening who want to get involved in that conversation, how do they do that?
I think look in your communities. There are groups. I mean, one of the wonderful things is things are forming spontaneously. I'd start in your neighborhood to see what's going on. I'd look to the groups that you belong to, whether it's your church or professional groups, to see what they are doing. I think there's a lot of quiet organizing going on.
And can people come to the events that your organization has and join, or do they have to just attend?
They have to be a guest of a member, because we have space limitations.
Sure.
We do have one event that people are welcome to attend, and that is our Women in the Forefront lunch, which will be on March 31st at the Hilton. Tickets are on sale now, and we are honored to have Valerie Jarrett as our keynote speaker. She will be incredibly uplifting and motivational.
Kate, it's good to meet you. Thanks for being on the opening bell, and
thank
best
you.
Of luck in the year ahead.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Kate Benson is the president and CEO at the Chicago Network. You can find more about them at thechicagonetwork.org. You can follow Kate on Twitter at TCN Chicago CEO, the group at TCN Chicago. Chicago Network, connecting Chicago's women leaders, inspiring the next generation of women leaders, and advancing our civic, business, and philanthropic communities in the female community.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. It's 5:39 on this Monday edition of The Opening Bell. Some stories we're watching for you as we move toward 8:30 in the bell. A private watchdog group says counterfeit goods, software piracy, and the theft of trade secrets cost the American economy as much as $600 billion a year. In a report out today, the Commission on Theft of American Intellectual Property says the annual loss ranged from about $225 billion to $600 billion. The theft of trade secrets alone costs the United States between $180 and $500 billion annually. Counterfeit goods cost the United States $29 billion to $41 billion annually. Pirated software cost an additional $18 billion a year. Billionaire Warren Buffett wants investors to be wary of the high fees Wall Street routinely charges because of the damage they do to investment returns. He's emphasizing he's confident in the U.S. economy moving forward. Buffett devoted a section of his annual letter to Berkshire Hathaway shareholders over the weekend to explaining again the benefits of low-cost index funds over most other investments. He says he estimates that wealthy investors who use high-priced advisors have wasted more than $100 billion over the past decades. How far will some people go to make money and have power? The new book is out called Deadly Prescription, shows what happens when profit becomes more important than life. Prescription medicine controversy at the forefront of most of our conversations these days as the government considers a repeal and replace of Obamacare, also with the high cost of some drugs. Dr. Robert Marks is the author. He's a professor of surgery and chief of the Division of Oral and Maxillofacial Surgery at the University of Miami's Miller School of Medicine. And he's with us this morning on the Opening Bell. Dr. Marks, good morning.
Good morning to you. Thank you for having me.
We're glad to have you with us because this is a topic I think a lot of people are wondering about and are concerned about on a daily basis. Tell us about deadly prescription. What has your experience been, and why did you write this book?
My definite play in all of this, I've been an expert witness against several of the drug companies and had naively thought that they were honest and forthright, but I learned of the internal corruption, the dark side of big pharma. I see a number of people with what's called dead bone in the jaws, over 500 cases. Many of these are drugs that the drug company should have known would have caused this and ignored it, did sloppy research, and then when it was revealed to them, they denied it.
So this is a situation, we think of the pharma bro and we think of the EpiPen controversy. Are these just tips of the iceberg of the real story about what's happening with big pharma?
Oh, you hit it right on the head. It is a tip of the iceberg. The more you look into it, the more you see some real serious corruption. I mean, take a look at Merck. They did the Vioxx scandal, the Fosamax scandal, which I was involved with, and now the Gardasil scandal where this vaccine that's supposed to prevent young girls from developing genital cancers and such has been shown by their lead researcher to be ineffective, and the side effects have been underreported. So, yes, it is the tip of the iceberg.
If you spend any time watching television, especially late at night, you see almost see one ad right after the other, not only for new drugs, but for lawsuits against new drugs. How bad has this situation become? Are there really this many problems with drugs?
Probably not, no. I mean, you're absolutely right. There's just a few drugs that have been put into the mix of some very good drugs. The pharmaceutical industry has done well on one hand in producing new and relatively effective drugs. What they've not been is just upright and forthright with the people who take these drugs about the seriousness of the complications, the number of the complications, and when they occur. For instance, all of the medications I just discussed went through randomized prospective double-blind controlled studies, the golden science that we all look for, and were approved by the FDA. It wasn't until real people took them in the real world that all the side effects came out.
Well, hearing this story, I just had a shiver go up my back on this because we're all sort of hoping and counting on our doctors and the pharmaceutical community to be right on this because our lives depend on it. How do we know when we're getting into a situation that could eventually threaten our life or take our life?
You really don't know. That's just the concern that I have. It is a little bit of a crapshoot, if you will, simply because what I have learned is we can't trust the drug companies to come up with honest research. They bamboozle the public. They bamboozle the FDA. And one of the real problems is the FDA is underfunded and understaffed. So when a drug company brings a medication to the FDA for approval, they bring the drug company's data, which is either horribly massaged or in some cases outright phony, for lack of a better term. It gets approved, and then when the real people take it, 2 years later, 3 years later, all these side effects start coming out.
So what needs to happen here? Are you even more concerned now that you hear the Trump administration talked about rolling back regulations and maybe repealing and replacing Obamacare and having his hands in all of this. What would be the solution?
Oh, there is a solution. It doesn't involve anything to do with the current president or even regulations. Some regulations are good. Some regulations are bad. It's the bad ones you need to remove and the good ones you need to keep. But probably the better thing to do is empower the FDA with more authority. Number two is to, after a drug is on the market for 5 years, have a review of the actual effects on people. And then many of these drugs would have lost their approval by the FDA. Once it's approved forever and ever. There should be a recertification of a drug. And I think that would go a long way to improving the detriment that we see with certain drugs.
It's sort of like a probationary period almost.
On a provisional approval, it goes out on the market, and when we start seeing some of the unanticipated consequences, side effects, the FDA gets a chance to put restrictions on them. Now, there is a little bit of something like that, but Merck in particular dodged around what is called a black box warning with their drug Fosamax. They didn't use their name of their drug. They just used the classification in their so-called black box warning. And that's what I would advise to many of your readers. When you take a drug or you're prescribed a medication, look in the internet and see some of the other side of the coin, and also ask your pharmacist for the product description. The product description will have 25 pages of fine print, but focus right in on what is called the black box warning. This is what the FDA requires of drug companies to put in their most serious and most common side effects. A lot of the public doesn't know about that.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that because I was a couple of years ago prescribed an asthma medication that had a black box warning on it. It wasn't until 6 months into it that I realized it was a black box warning. So we find out there is a black box warning. What do we do then?
Well, you then discuss it with your physician. You know, do the benefits outweigh the risks? And that's always been the problem. And that's the second problem that I think this book of mine reveals, is that when the drug companies have an issue with a drug, what they do is they start paying their paid consultants large sums of money to do research, which has shown how good their drug is and how minimal the side effects. I could point to several of them out on the market today.
In your book, Deadly Prescription, you write that in the way that I read this is there's really sort of a moral aspect to the drug companies. It's probably the bigger problem, isn't it? Just the way they operate.
Yeah,
go ahead.
No, yes, indeed. Here, as physicians, we need to take ethics courses. I don't see the drug companies having to take ethics courses. I would like to see them have some ethical responsibilities, because all of these side effects, if you knew the mechanism of the drug, could have been anticipated at least.
One drug rep once told me, doing a story, that they'll never ever cure another disease because they won't make money that way. If that's the thinking, that's kind of a scary thinking, isn't it?
It is, and that is the prime directive of many of these drug companies. They're called blockbuster drugs. I mean, you can name them. It is Viagra. It is Valium. It is Fosamax. It is Gardasil now. These are all the medications that of many people take them at whatever cost.
The drug companies, too, will argue that they do play an important role in our health. Obviously, there are a lot of people alive today that wouldn't be without some of these drugs. Is there a happy medium here, and do we need more patient-oriented advocacy?
Yes, indeed you do. I think you hit it right on the head once again. To be honest with everybody, these drugs have a good beneficial value. And probably the one for osteoporosis that I'm involved in is that the FDA finally caught up with them based on many people's recommendation, including mine. Women who take an osteoporosis drug need to be retested after 3 years, and it's unlikely anyone needs it for more than 5 years. And yet the drug company people tell postmenopausal women to take it the rest of their lives. That's where the problem comes in.
The book is called Deadly Prescription. The author is Dr. Robert Marks. Dr. Marks, thanks for being on the Opening Bell this morning. Thanks for sharing this book.
And thank you for having me once again.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program at 5:53 on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning. Dow futures are flat, off almost 2 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures are mixed, looking for a flat open as we head toward the opening bell later this morning. Let's get the latest now on agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. We begin a five-day trading week again, and as we look back to last Friday, cattle traders ahead of the close squaring up their positions ahead of the cattle on feed report, but there was no change really in that cattle on feed report from what was expected, the number up 1% from the same period a year ago, 10,782,000 cattle in feedlots. The most active April contract finished $1.57 lower on Friday. And the hog market tended to, again, have an interesting trading week with the April contract ending on Friday up $1.45 a hundredweight. Turning to the grain market, we saw wheat, corn falling to two-week lows, long liquidation. Soybeans, on the other hand, closed modestly higher on Friday. Now, looking ahead to the end of February and the beginning of March, first of all, weather will be watched carefully. Will it come in like a lamb or a lion? But the other event this week takes place in San Antonio, Texas, and that's the Commodity Classic. It gets underway on Thursday the 2nd, continues through Saturday the 4th. Max Armstrong will be there to cover that event of wheat growers and sorghum growers and corn growers and soybean growers. Commodity Classic in San Antonio. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You have a great day as well. Now, the Associated Bank Market Desk outlook for this Monday, February 27th. The Commerce Department releases durable goods orders report for January. The National Association of Realtors releases pending home sales for January as well. The U.S. Senate expected to vote on the nomination of Wilbur Ross to be the Commerce Secretary this evening. That will be followed by a vote on the motion to invoke cloture on the nomination of Ryan Zinke as Interior Secretary. President Trump meets at the White House with the governors, U.S. governors, who are wrapping up their annual winter meeting in Washington. The World Health Organization publishes its first ever catalog of 12 families of bacteria that pose the greatest threat to human health. And the Mobile World Congress, MWC, event in Barcelona gets underway with product announcements expected from Samsung, Nokia, LG, and others ahead of the event, with devices then going on display.